tonight they step off the plane as refugees, but they walk out of this terminal as permanent residents of Canada with social insurance numbers and with an opportunity to become full Canadians. And this is something that we are able to do in this country because we define a Canadian not by a skin color or a language or a religion or a background, but by a shared set of values, aspirations, hopes, and dreams that not just Canadians, but people around the world share.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau welcoming Syrian refugees into his country last holiday season. Canada has accepted more than triple the number of Syrian refugees as the United States has. We'll have more on that in a minute. But first, seconds after a gunman killed a Russian diplomat at an art gallery in Ankara, Turkey yesterday, an AP photographer chose to raise his camera to his eye instead of taking cover. The image he created went viral. It shows the assassin, gun in one hand, the other hand pointed to the ceiling. He's wearing a well-cut suit, a skinny tie, and he's yelling. The body of Russian diplomat Andrei Karlov lies at his feet. The dead body, which gave many photo editors pause as they decided what to post on their websites about the assassination. Well, joining us to talk about that and how photos can be used to change the public perception of conflicts is Michael Whitley, managing editor for design at the LA Times. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And also Michael Shaw joins us. He writes about photography for the Columbia Journalism Review. Welcome to you.
Thanks very much.
All right, let's begin with you, Michael Whitley, as one of the editors making the decision to put this paper, this photo in the paper. What were you thinking when you first saw that image?
Well, I mean, this one, to me, it was actually one of the easier decisions we've made in terms of a really tough photograph, just because the news value of the photograph is extremely high, that it's a public official, an ambassador who's entitled to the protections in the country that he's an ambassador to, and that he suffered a public death. And so it also is a photograph that could serve to destabilize a region that's already pretty volatile. So we had a discussion about this one yesterday in terms of the difficulty that we've had in terms of publishing photographs. I actually found this one was an easier decision for us just because of that high news value and because of the very public nature of it.
I mean, did you discuss cropping it so the body wasn't in the photo?
We looked at different views of it, too. There was actually quite a few photographs that that photographer took. There were views from behind. There were views from the side. We felt like that including him was important in that it's his death. It's his diplomatic mission and the death that he suffered as a result of taking that diplomatic mission on for his country. And so we felt like that excluding him, even though it would make the photo, you know, maybe a little more palatable to some people, in some ways it also dishonored the death that he suffered.
Interesting. Was there ever a time where you decided not to publish an image because it was too graphic? And
I'd say probably at least once a month that we come up against something like that. I mean, the nature of the conflicts that exist in the world right now, we see very graphic, very violent photographs almost on a daily basis. And always what we're doing is measuring that news value of the photograph. And, you know, it's sort of a harsh reality because we're talking about people's lives here, but at the same time, we don't want to overdo it. It tends to desensitize people to the truth of things that are happening if you just publish those type of photographs all the time. But when there's a really high news value to it, then I think you come to it and you start to say, okay, are we okay with maybe offending some of our audience in order to show something that is different seeing it than it is reading it?
Okay, Michael Shaw, let's bring you in. This particular image was shared a lot of times on social media. You couldn't really avoid it. What do you think about the ethics surrounding this? Do newspapers have a responsibility, and for that matter, television stations and anyone else, to be sensitive about these images?
Well, I think that the modesty concern is actually an antiquated one. And, you know, it used to be that media would talk about the breakfast table test. Which is that can the image would the image offend somebody eating their breakfast if a particular image was seen above the fold? And actually, it's interesting that a great example of the difference is the last, I believe it's Thursday's New York Times front page, where they were talking about how the images from Syria don't seem to be really having an impact on anyone, even those video testimonials that came out. And they published a collage of four images, including the Alan Kurdi photo, the boy washed up on the beach, And the picture of Amran Dakhnish, who was in the back of that ambulance. And those four pictures were above the fold. So, you know, I think we've moved on. And in fact, you know, we're in the Trump era, right? So what Donald Trump's doing every day in terms of tone and attitude on Twitter, I think that the visual media is already, you know, basically operating in that same set of norms also now.
Interesting. Well, do you feel that way, Michael Whitley? Do you feel like there's a different way of talking now that Donald Trump has become the president? I mean, do you think that there's a new conversation being had when it comes to what's acceptable and what's not in terms of printing images?
You know, I don't think of it necessarily that way. I constantly think about what we think is right for the LA Times and for our audience, and that's a different bar than other publications may have. There are times where we've held back on something that another publication has published, and there are times where we're alone in publishing something. When Ambassador Stevens was killed in Libya, we were one of the only U.S. papers that fronted that photograph. And for us, it's all about feeling comfortable with the decision that we've made, and if we feel like we are sharing the right information with our audience, and, you know, withholding things that we think aren't necessarily as necessary or as important, but giving them things, even things that may offend them a little bit, but we think have such a high news value that we need to publish it. But there is definitely a change in terms of, I think, the information people are willing to see and accept and understand that the world has become so much more visual that seeing something is so different than reading it. And a great example of that is, you know, the New York Times recently published an incredible series of photographs about the war on drugs in the Philippines. And it's a lot of really tough images. I mean, it's depicting the deaths of quite a few people. And but at the same time, when you see it, it is just viscerally different than having read the same information. Like, it gives you a different understanding of what is really happening in the Philippines right now.
And Michael Shaw, do you think there's a difference in terms of a static image, a photograph, versus something you watch on television? Because the video of the gunman was also shown on television, moving images. Do you think that has a different effect on people?
Yeah, it's funny. With the decline of print and the rise of the internet, there was a lot of debate and hand-wringing in the photo community, the editorial community, about the death of the still photograph. And you saw all the photographers running to buy these SLRs, and, you know, everyone was going to learn to do video. And what ended up happening, especially with then the rise of sites like Instagram and this, you know, there's been a proliferation of stills. And in fact, you know, the way that we process a still image is much more powerful than if we see something on video. And that's because the image, at the eidetic quality, you know, it gets into our heads. We bring a lot more of ourself to the image in terms of ownership and connection and filling in the story. So, in fact, I think this still image has never been more important and more powerful.
Now, I remember during the Iraq War, some editors were loath to publish photographs or video of Americans returning home who had been killed in coffins. And has that changed, do you think?
Well, I think that was much more a political factor there than it mm-hmm. was about sensitivity and taste. You know, with the fact that war coverage now is a function or is governed by embedding and the government having that kind of control or filtration over the images, I don't think it's about sensibility. I think that was more about politics.
And Michael Whitley, what are you hearing from your readers? Did you hear anything when you published that photograph?
You know, today not much. I think, and the other thing that's happening with the instantness of the digital world is, you know, people have often they come to us to read about an image that they've already seen. You know, they may have seen it on social media. Someone may have shared it with them, and so they actually are coming to us to find out more about what happened. So we're not even necessarily the first place that they're going to see a picture like that anymore. So, you know, we definitely hear from readers occasionally about things that we do. But, you know, in this instance, I don't think it was really a big deal to them.
Well, I want to thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Michael Whitley, managing editor for design at the LA Times. Michael Shaw writes about photography for the Columbia Journalism Review, and he runs the nonprofit website Reading the Pictures. And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think news outlets should have run that photo as much as they did, as much as it was shared on social media, or any photo? Was there one photo recently that you saw in a news organization, at a news outlet, that disturbed you, that you thought should not have been published? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Despite the assassination of the ambassador, Russia and Turkey today promised to continue their talks about the ongoing conflict in Syria. The two nations have been working together to evacuate civilians in the rebel-held parts of Aleppo, where thousands of people are still trapped. Millions of people have fled Syria since the war started nearly 6 years ago, and Canada is among the countries most willing to accept and help these refugees. That country has accepted nearly 38,000 Syrians in just the last year. Compare that to the United States, which has a much bigger population. It only accepted 10,000 Syrian refugees. New York Times reporter Jody Cantor has been following a few of these families as they make new lives in Canada, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, in terms of resettling these refugees, what is Canada doing differently from the United States, Germany, other European countries?
You know, Madeline, we've spent a whole year on this story, and it's really because we found out that Canada was placing the opposite bet on Syrian refugees as the rest of the world. The U.S. is kind of typical in that, you know, politically there's been a sort of hesitant, even hostile attitude towards the refugees. In Canada, everyday people are helping bring these refugees over and adopting them. Book clubs, gardening clubs, poker buddies, school groups. They saw these photos of these suffering Syrian children, and they decided to organize and help bring these families over. And Canada has this special thing called sponsorship that allows you to do that. So we said to ourselves, wait a second, these kind of amateur everyday people with no connection to the Middle East are going to be personally resettling Syrian refugees who don't even know about this relationship yet. And we said we wanted to see how this plays out.
Okay, so you profiled a few of these families and a few of the sponsors, and your latest story centers on this 10-year-old girl named Bayan. And talk about her and how her story really represents sort of the tensions that exist when a young girl is trying to assimilate in a Western country and she comes from a very traditional culture.
So Bayan gets to Canada. She's now 10 years old. So, you know, picture her landing in Canada a year ago. And this kid's appetite to soak up everything and experience everything is like over the top. I mean, this is a kid who, you know, had to leave Syria when she was 7 or 8. She lived in refugee camps in Jordan. And she gets to Canada within a week. She is ice skating fluidly, you know, loves her new school, makes a very diverse set of friends. You know, generally, one detail we really loved about her is that she loves to watch like the movie Annie and the ballet Cinderella and even Wheel of Fortune, all sort of metaphors, I think, for her own transformation and change of luck. Mm. So she is like, what she says to us is, I just want to be Canadian. She's dazzled by this new world in which she's found herself. Her parents have a different reaction. Not only are they very traditional, they are, you know, very strict Muslims. They're from a very small village in Syria, a pretty rural area. It's not just that. It's also the fact that, you know, they're refugees. They never asked to come to Canada. They're delighted that they ended up there, and they're thunderstruck by the generosity being shown to them. But they're still trying to hang on to Syria in some way, and they're watching it be obliterated from afar. So the question of whether Bayan will remain Syrian in what way and what that means is very fraught for them in the sense of, you know, they don't know what path she's going to follow in life now. She's even saying that she doesn't want to wear a headscarf, which is a really difficult thing for them to hear.
And when does a girl typically put on the headscarf? At what age?
So if they lived in Syria, she would already be wearing it. And now she's trying to postpone.
Oh, interesting. And so you mentioned the word obliterated, and they're watching the literal obliteration of many parts of their country, including Aleppo. But are they looking at their own daughter and seeing their culture in a way being obliterated by her assimilation?
Well, she's just becoming Canadian so fast. You know, their ideal is that they say they want her to take the best of Canada and the best of Syria. And they're thrilled about, you know, for example, the educational opportunity she has in Canada. But the sponsors are doing a great job of introducing this family to Canada. But because they're doing such a good job, they're introducing the kids to different things, right? The kids want to trick or treat on Halloween. They get invited to do a million Christmas things. They get invited to go swimming. These are things that, you know, for us, for most of us, feel totally routine, totally unthreatening. The family perceives them in a different way. You know, Bayan wearing a bathing suit in front of other people, especially as she's going into adolescence, these things are all giant questions for the parents.
Is it also because she's a girl and there's a lot of tension over girls' roles and how much freedoms they should have in traditional societies, traditional Muslim societies?
Well, part of what was really fascinating about our reporting is that, you know, we've followed this family for a long time, and eventually the parents opened up to us about their marriage. And this is not just true for them. I think it's true for Syrians largely as a category. When they come to places like North America, it's really rough on their marriages. And what I'm talking about is the group that has traditional marriages. Bayan's parents had an arranged marriage back in Syria. Her mom was subject to extremely strict rules about what she did and, you know, had to ask her husband permission for everything. Well, they come to Canada and the rules are totally different. And Bayan's mom has actually had a much easier time in Canada than her father, because her mom has been flooded with new opportunities. She has so much more mobility. She has so much more freedom. She is getting to try things she could never try before. Whereas her dad feels a little displaced because he used to be head of the household. His authority was unquestioned, and that's not true anymore.
Interesting. So the mom is maybe more optimistic and wants to stay in Canada, and the dad is thinking, well, if things improve, we can move back to Syria?
Exactly. They have a very different point of view. Now, they have a very warm marriage, and, you know, they're committed to sort of navigating these differences together, but there are other Syrian marriages that really kind of fall on the rocks when they get to the U.S. or Canada. In Canada, we heard about a lot of cases where women were finally reporting domestic abuse, which had happened for years, but for the first time, they felt safe to tell the authorities.
And how are they welcomed into the larger society? We've heard so much rhetoric here in the United States and elsewhere in Europe, the anti-immigrant rhetoric. Are they viewed at all with suspicion on the streets in Toronto?
Very little. Canada has a totally different attitude than most countries, especially in an era when it feels like borders are closing and xenophobia is rising. This is partly because they've never had a kind of 9/11 event the way we have. Their border situation is really different. They only have one border with the United States. They barely have any illegal immigration problems. They're even more protected than we are from the flow of refugees throughout the Middle East and Europe. And also their population is much smaller relative to their land mass than the U.S. is. So their idea is kind of that, you know, they need these new Canadians, that they're going to populate and enrich in the country.
Well, Jody, thank you so much. This was really interesting. And you have other pieces coming later on?
Yes, we have other pieces coming. You can read the whole series at nytimes.com/refugees, and we hope to have a new one for you in the new year.
Jody Cantor, reporter for The New York Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
And we'd like to hear from you. How do you think the U.S. should be handling the refugee crisis in Syria? You can tell us your thoughts on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, what happens when homeless people are moved into housing? Well, their problems are not automatically solved. The story of one woman's struggle to stay afloat. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Over the summer, we profiled a homeless woman living on LA's Skid Row. Her name is Dawn Gann. We followed her around for a day to find out what her life was like.
When it becomes morning, those are the people that have been up all night. And then you have at like the evening, everybody getting ready to party. Now people have been drinking all day, doing drugs all day. So it just starts to get a little violent.
Since then, Dawn has moved off the streets and into housing, but it's not quite a happy ending, at least not yet. Press Play producer Anna Scott checks in with her situation.
Only 5 months ago, Dawn slept in a crowded dorm at a homeless shelter. Now she has her own bedroom, where she's pasted a trail of butterfly stickers to the wall above her bed.
My butterflies. I love butterflies. It's peaceful. My comfy pillows. I have about 1, 2, 3, 4 pillows. And I always have the window open, fresh air.
Her first night here, Dawn went to bed early.
It felt so good to lay in a bed that was mine, that I can call my bed, and just lay down. It was so, I cried.
Dawn got this 2-bedroom apartment through what's called a rapid rehousing program, funded by LA County. Technically, she got half the apartment. She could get a roommate at any time. But for now, she has the place to herself.
And then the spare bedroom that I use, like my kids use it when they spend the night.
This boxy apartment on a sleepy street in Covina, which is a suburb about 20 miles east of downtown LA, is Dawn's refuge, at least for now. The kind of program she got it through, rapid rehousing, provides a short-term bridge between the streets and a permanent home. When Dawn first moved here, she paid about $200 a month towards rent. That's a third of her income. Since then, under the terms of the program, her rent's gone up a little each month. And within a year, she'll be responsible for paying the full $913. She's only halfway there, but she's already falling behind.
It's been real tough. I scrape on food. I get $189 for food stamps. This month, I had to get my bearings fixed in my car, so that was $240. So I'm a little minus in my account right now.
So how have you kept making the rent?
I've had to do a couple extracurricular activities, side jobs like cleaning house.
Are you worried about becoming homeless again?
Very worried. Very, very worried.
Dawn has an internship with an LA nonprofit that helps people who are currently homeless. It pays a stipend, less than minimum wage. She says she's been turned down for other jobs because of her record, which includes DUIs. She also admits she's not doing the work training that comes with her rapid rehousing arrangement, partly because that wouldn't pay anything, not immediately. So it's not clear how Dawn will catch up with her rent. In that, she's not alone.
The biggest challenge that we're facing is that the rents in LA are extremely high. And even if you have somebody who has a decent income, it's still difficult to find units.
Julie DeRose is the director of permanent housing services for The People Concern, the nonprofit that placed Dawn in her apartment. DeRose couldn't talk specifically about Dawn's case, but she said when people can't keep up with the demands of rapid rehousing, there are other options. They don't just toss people back onto the streets.
I think people can stay housed. I think everyone can stay housed with the right kind of supports. I think sometimes we just haven't found the right support to help that person, and we need to keep trying.
But others say that too often, the right support just isn't there.
Rapid rehousing seldom has the kind of service support that's needed.
Sam Tsemberis is president of Pathways Housing First, an organization that works around the country on solving homelessness. He says for some homeless people, like economic victims who have never been on the streets before, programs offering limited help can work well. People with deeper problems, though, might need financial assistance or counseling for life in order to remain housed. And those resources aren't always there. The federally funded Section 8 program, for example, which provides long-term housing subsidies, has a waiting list of thousands in LA County alone.
I think that there's a discomfort in the idea that people will need help for a long time. And there is a sort of a core belief that regardless of your circumstances, you should just, by virtue of sheer will and resourcefulness, and by becoming a good person, you should be able to get it together.
And how possible do you think that is for most chronically homeless people, people that end up homeless over and over again?
I think the group that you're describing, the chronically homeless, are people that have a lot of complex needs. And they are capable of getting it together, but they need a lot of support and ongoing support in order to do that.
They have complex needs, like Dawn. She's had repeated bouts of homelessness in her life. Drug addiction has been the main cause. But the homelessness recurred even after she got sober, and she struggles to explain it. Why do you think it is that you ended up homeless so many times?
Well, I got divorced, and then to keep a job, you know, without any education and skills, it's tough.
There's a lot of factors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel that you're more capable now of maintaining stability?
Will I be able to be a normal, productive citizen? That's my goal. I hope I can. I hope that this works out so I can.
Yeah, but you don't know yet.
Right.
Yeah.
It's definitely not something that I can say will never happen again, because I could be right back on the street with nowhere to go.
I hope that you don't. I hope you don't.
Yeah, me too.
For Press Play, I'm Anna Scott.
Coming up on the program, the challenges faced by pioneering women athletes.
He gave them this space that was an abandoned trash dump, and it had old tin cans and broken beer bottles. There was actually like sewage running through that was called the Langston Golf Course.
Sports Heroines, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What are your favorite movies about sports heroes? Raging Bull, Hoosiers, The Blind Side, Rocky? What do they all have in common? Yeah, all the heroes are men. So where are all the female sports heroes? Well, Molly Shiat wondered that, and so she decided to investigate. The result is a new book. It's called Game Changers, The Unsung Heroines of Sports History. And Molly Shiat joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
So this originally was an idea, you're a TV director and a film director, and this was originally an idea for a TV series, right?
Yeah, there is a sports series, and I decided to kind of break the mold and be like, hey, I'm going to get one of these made, and my secret weapon is I'm going to find a story about a woman, because there are none, and everyone will be like, oh my gosh, this is genius, there's a story about a woman, and none of them got greenlit. They all got kind of somehow turned down, whether it was not interesting enough or that's not really our audience. So I was really frustrated and decided to compile all those stories and then started the Instagram account.
So the Instagram account, it's called Unsung Heroines.
Yeah, the Unsung Heroines. So it's basically all of these rejected pitches and ideas that I took and put into a more modern day platform so people could learn their stories and figure out who they were. But a lot of the stories are from the 40s and 50s and 60s, so you can't really find them on the internet or Googling them. So a lot of the stories came from the LA 84 Library and the Los Angeles Public Library.
Wait, what's the LA 84 Library?
The LA 84 Library is the biggest sports library in the world. It's basically like came out of the LA 84 Olympics. And there's a torch in the middle of the library that's burning, and it has every single sports fact book novel under the sun.
Oh my gosh. And so you went in there and just found a treasure trove of information about these women who...
Yeah, I originally went to the LA Public Library, and all the books were really depressing that were about women. It was like, she's got game, or like, what a knockout. And they were just so embarrassing. And the librarian said, you should check out the LA 84 library. And it was literally walking into the most fascinating museum. And it's also like in an old house in the West Adams district.
Huh.
And everyone's really nice. And they fund a lot of inner city stuff with kids and sports. So it's like a great place to go and work.
Okay. And so you began this research. And did you have any idea? Because you have how many people in here? Well over 150.
So there's 140 in the book. And uh-huh. then I've posted 900 posts. So it's every day I post a story. So it was originally just going in there to find information to pitch these stories to make one into a documentary. And then when they said no, it's kind of just been this almost therapeutic process, like finding all these women and just admiring everything that they've been through.
One of the stories that you pitched TV was on the Wake Robin Golf Club. This
yeah.
is a golf club made up of African-American women.
Yeah. So I found out about these 13 women in the late 30s. And these 13 women gathered in this woman's home named Helen Webb Harris. And they had their first official meeting because all of the 13 women wanted to play golf. So they began petitioning to desegregate the public courses and not the private, more affluent ones. And every course just said no. At that time, the people that were African American that were on golf courses, their roles were caddies or shining golf shoes, or they worked in the kitchens. So these women went to the Secretary of the Interior in 1938, and they said, what can you do to help us? All we want to do is play golf. So he designated a place in Northwest Washington, D.C., and he gave them this space that was an abandoned trash dump. And it had old tin cans and broken beer bottles.
That's so sad.
Broken wine bottles. There was actually like sewage running through the course.
Oh my gosh.
That was called the Langston Golf Course. And other minority clubs would play there. And they made it their own, and they were really prideful of the course because it was like their place to play and like do what they wanted to do. And the woman at Wake Robin also joined up with other minority golf clubs in the area and petitioned the PGA, which is the Professional Golfers Association, to drop the whites-only rule in the 60s. And the club remains active today as like one of the courses that fosters and encourages women to play golf that are African American.
So they integrated golf for everyone.
Yeah, these women did.
So they are heroes.
They're my heroes, and a lot of them are still around, and the club still exists. And you know, it was one of those things where I just couldn't believe that film, let alone me making it. I just can't believe that film hasn't been told before.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Molly Shiat. She's the author of a new book called Game Changers, The Unsung Heroines of Sports History. A lot of the stories, surprisingly to me, a lot of the stories take place in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So this is during the era of women's liberation. And I guess maybe it's not surprising that there was a lot of pushback. And one of the most surprising for me was reading about Catherine Switzer, who
yeah.
ran the Boston Marathon and experienced a lot of pushback.
Yeah. So at the time, she was 20 years old and she registered in the Boston Marathon with the initials KV. And she got up to the starting line and there was 741 runners that were competing that day. And she was the only woman. And she wore a gray hoodie, gray sweatpants. It was ice cold and it was in April, which is unusual. And she started running and she was with a couple of her friends that were men. And as she was running, there was a truck that pulled up beside her with photographers, press, journalists. It's kind of like the press van or press mm-hmm. truck. And there was a man that was on it that jumped off the truck and violently ran towards her and tried to rip her bib off, which was number 261, and started screaming at her and said, get the hell out of my race. Give me your bib. Get out of here. And he grabbed her bib and pulled her. And then her friend ended up running up to this man and just knocking him over.
And he wasn't even a runner, right, this guy?
He was the director of the Boston Athletic Association. His name was Jock Semple, and this man that was running with Catherine just knocked him over. And she finished the race, and she said that it was just all she wanted to do. Even if she was on her hands and knees crawling, she just wanted to finish it. So she finished the race, and the next day they were at a gas station, and they saw the newspaper, and she was all over it.
But even think, what's so threatening about a woman running in a marathon? Why would people be so upset about that?
I mean, they say the same thing about a woman running for president. So I think it's just one of those strikes that you have against you.
Well, I see the argument with a woman running for president because she has real power, right? But a woman running a race, I mean, what kind of threat is that?
I mean, I don't think there's that much of a difference. I think that if there is a woman that might do better or might assert some sort of confidence, or where they say that women aren't allowed to run in this marathon, and she asserts herself and signs up and runs, then it's breaking some sort of...
It is a threat.
Yeah.
Yeah. To the order.
It's just so lame.
Also, women who covered men's sports, the early pioneers, they experienced a lot of horrific harassment in the locker room, which you profile.
Yeah. The other woman that is in the book that was a journalist at the time was named Lisa Olson. And I vaguely remember my parents telling me about it then. But working on this project and finding these stories, I really wanted to find a balance of not only athletes, but women that were writers and journalists. So Lisa never set out to be a sports writer, but she went to graduate school at Harvard, and right out of Harvard got a job at the Boston Herald. And in September in 1990, she was asked to cover a few different Patriots that had injuries. And she went into the locker room and immediately was surrounded by a group of five men that pulled their towels off and started to embarrass her in ways that I couldn't even talk about on public radio and can't repeat the things that they said because it's so disgusting and it's so horrific. And she ended up leaving the locker room and said that she was in this state of just feeling total blind rage and felt like she had been mentally raped and assaulted. And she ended up going home, and her paper at the time was trying to figure out how to deal with the problem. And the Patriots owner was this man named Victor Kean, and he said, I couldn't disagree with what the players did. That's just a woman asking for trouble, going into a locker room and covering that. And that's what happens when you assign a female reporter to a men's locker room. That's just like what they sign up for. And as the paper started to challenge it and protect her, he called her a classic bitch, and an investigation was launched with the NFL. And the NFL ended up fining the New England Patriots players $5,000 apiece. And when that happened, she got an avalanche of like the most obscene phone calls, hate mail, death threats. The tunnel through Boston was spray painted with like, we're going to kill you. There was just nonstop horrific harassment that she received, and her tires were slashed, her home was burglarized, and she was left notes on her door that said, leave Boston or die. So she left, and she went to Australia and kind of went off the grid. And I tried to reach out to her numerous times to just talk to her about that experience, and I know that multiple people have, but I still think it's a uncomfortable thing to talk mm-hmm. about. But she is one of the women that really opened up doors for a lot of female journalists that cover sports. And they all respect her so much.
Lisa Olson
yeah.
is her name. So Where are we now, do you think? I mean, we have plenty of female sports journalists, plenty of female star athletes. Where do you think we are now?
It's a funny question. It's like an interesting question because I feel like a lot of people that ask me that usually say, you know, we're in this golden age of women and sports and, you know, our women's team and there's so much coverage and things are great and the women's gymnastic team and all these things are changing. But I think it's just a really small step. At the LA 84 Library, they had this paper called Dude Time, and it was written by these professors at USC, and 97% of all sports coverage is men, and the 3% that is about women isn't necessarily about women playing sports. So it's about, you know, who Hope Solo is dating or Abby Wambach's DUI, and it's just like they're not covering, you know, the important beats that are really significant and really important.
Yeah, it seems that sports coverage of women is usually about singular women, stars like Ronda Rousey,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah.
Or it's only during the Olympics.
Right. Yeah. And then I think that what's also really interesting is sponsorship. And you think about like Janet Guthrie, who was like the first female NASCAR race car driver. And she had to basically stop racing because she couldn't get sponsorship. And I think about women today that are on the U.S. women's national soccer team that get so much coverage and there's so much press and they're so good and they're huge role models, but their salaries are just really bad.
Mm-hmm. And they have to play on AstroTurf.
Yeah, they have to play on AstroTurf. So I don't know, like, where are we at? I think that things are changing and I think that things are a lot better. It's just important to just keep the conversation moving.
Molly Shiat is a film and TV director. She's author of the new book. It's called Game Changers, The Unsung Heroines of Sports History. Thank you.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Yesterday, President Obama granted clemency to 231 people. That's the most in a single day by any U.S. president. And it brings the total to more than 1,300 people. Well, a pair of friends in Modesto hope they're on Obama's list. Back in 2004, Luke Scarmazzo and Ricardo Montez opened a pot dispensary called California Healthcare Collective. The cash poured in. They paid themselves $13,000 each a month. One of them even posted a music video on YouTube bragging about his dough and flipping off the feds.
When it comes to the pies, I know I'm so slick, yeah. Vacuum saver so the dogs can't sniff. Take a whiff of this lavender smoke, and it could stick right to the back of windows. And these indoors packs hit for 48 a bowl. Now that's what I call incorporating dough. I'm a businessman, I mean business.
All right, and then after that video posted on YouTube, a couple of weeks later, the feds showed up. The friends were found guilty of running a criminal enterprise and sentenced to 20 years in prison. Now they're formally asking the president to grant them clemency. Peter Hecht reported this story for the Sacramento Bee. Hi.
Hi. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, tell us more about these guys. Who are they?
Well, it's just not only who they are, it's when they emerged. They came of age at a time when there were very few rules for medical marijuana in California. And the legislature passed something called that basically allowed medical marijuana patients to organize collectives. And it was inspired by a DEA raid on a garden in Santa Cruz with AIDS patients and leukemia patients and very seriously ill people. But what happened, particularly in places like Los Angeles and in the small town of Modesto, is people started opening retail-style stores, handling millions of dollars in transactions under the guise of being collectives and accepting donations from registered patients for their medicine. And these guys were part of that emergence of this industry, and they were in a small town, and they were flamboyant as all get out.
Yeah, you can see in that video, pretty flamboyant. So were they pretty much asking for the feds to come knocking when they posted that video?
It seems that way. Mm-hmm. It definitely seems that way. Now, they were not the only prosecution in that era. But in contrast, there was a dispensary operator named Charles Lynch in San Luis Obispo in the same era, and he was very, very professional and brought out the Chamber of Commerce and talked about marijuana as medicine and sort of walked the political walk. And he was also prosecuted. But in contrast, he got a year and a day in federal prison. These guys got 21 years for one of them and 20 years for the other. So you could argue that there was a case of disparate justice here. And certainly that's what their advocates are trying to do.
So now they're asking for clemency. And what's their argument?
Well, there is a multiplicity of arguments. One, that the feds added on this extra charge of operating a continuing criminal enterprise, which got them the 20 years. But two, namely, that times have changed. Congress, backed by two congressmen from California, Dana Rohrabacher and Sam Farr, put amendments into spending bills basically saying that Congress would not fund any DEA activities that interfered with state marijuana laws. So their proponents argue these people might not be even charged today. California has implemented vigorous regulations of the medical marijuana industry in response to a federal memo that came out a couple years ago saying the feds would sort of back off if states passed robust regulations. And the other thing is, we just had this incredible explosion of marijuana industries, not only in California, in Colorado, in Washington. We've got a critical mass of 26 states and the District of Columbia with some form of legal marijuana. So they're just saying, look, times have changed, and we're stuck in federal prison. Will they get attention from the president? I don't know. I think it's a real long shot.
Why is it a long shot, though?
It's a long shot from the legal experts that I've talked to. Given these guys, it's not just their flamboyance, it was the degree of profiteering. Mm. And some of the legal thought is that President Obama wants to right some of the inequities of the drug war, namely the unequal prosecutions with crack cocaine, the racial disparities aspects. And here you have these guys, beyond the music video, who are just packing away millions of dollars and really living the high life. So they don't engender necessarily the same degree of sympathy. On the other hand, they're clearly arguing that, look, times are different. We probably would not be raided today. And, you know, were they following California law at the time? Arguably not. Possibly yes. It was so nebulous that it was hard to define. There were no rules.
Yeah. Boy, but I bet they regret that video. 5 minutes.
Very, very much. Although I do think it was spectacular, by the way.
It's still, people can still watch it on YouTube. So what does it mean, with this new administration, Jeff Sessions becomes the next attorney general? What does that mean in general for the feds prosecuting dispensaries?
I think there's a lot of fears right now. I think the critical mass aspect of all of these states that have come forward with this, the fact that the feds had previously stepped back and issued this memo calling for state regulations will make it harder. I think a thing to watch is Congress. Will Rohrabacher put his amendment and Farr put their amendment forward again? But I think there's going to be some turbulence. It is not a marijuana-friendly attorney general by any means. And I think at minimum they're going to look for strategic prosecutions. Obviously, they're always going to go after interstate trafficking and things like that. But will they look for people that are kind of on the fringes of operating within state rules or going rogue? Yeah, I would think most likely. So it'll be interesting to see.
Well, Peter, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Peter Hecht is senior writer at the Sacramento Bee and author of the book Weedland. And Jolie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hello.
Hello. Everybody today wanted to talk about that image from out of Ankara, Turkey, the gunman who had just killed the Russian diplomat. And we had a discussion about when we want to see that, why we want to see that, how we want to see that. On Facebook, Andrew Amick and Cheryl Insilaco basically both had a, this is reality and we need to be confronted with it or else we're going to miss the point of what's going on in the world kind of reaction. But David Donnell says that he couldn't believe the New York Times posted the picture of the dead ambassador with the killer standing over him front and center on their webpage. He says it was surreal, like a screenshot from a cable drama. Are we so callous about death? And Marilee Lamarque says, sadly, if newspapers don't run the sensational images, they seem like complete dinosaurs in the internet era. When murder and mayhem are viewable on YouTube and all over the internet, we're in a new era of information exposure.
And that is definitely the case. Thank you very much, Jolie.
No problem.
Thank you, listeners. Please keep writing in. Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Same with Facebook. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.